they on? Physiological Society meeting at University College London, 25 March 1966. The second Bayliss-Starling Memorial Lecture to be delivered by Professor I. de Burgh Daly with Sir Charles Lovett Evans in the chair.
Of the second Bayliss-Starling Lecture. And the lecturer is already known to you all, Professor I. de Burgh Daly, who has worked with Bayliss and Starling. He was, I understand, rather more intimately connected with Bayliss than with Starling, though of course he contacted them both, and he derived, as everyone did who worked with them, a great deal from contact with both those important and magnetic personalities. I won't keep you very long in introducing him, because you want to hear him and not me. One point I would like to mention is that there will be a dinner, and after the dinner there will be a presentation to Professor Daly to commemorate this lecture and give him something that he can remember it by, if he's ever likely to forget it, which I'm sure we shall. So without any further ado, Professor I. de Burgh Daly to give the second Bayliss-Starling Memorial Lecture.
The invitation extended to me by the Physiological Society to deliver this, the second Bayliss-Starling Memorial Lecture, is a singular honor and one I greatly appreciate. But my appreciation is tinged with misgivings, for I am deeply conscious that to do justice to the memories of two such remarkable personalities is beyond my powers. I hope, however, to present certain aspects of their lives and works which may be of interest to you. My early memories of Bayliss and Starling cover the years 1919 to 1923. That was the time when Starling was replenishing his staff after the First World War, and when physiologists from abroad were once more able to visit his laboratory. In 1919, Bayliss was 59 years old, Starling was 53, and this year is the centenary of Starling's birth. I came to work under Starling purely by chance. I'd written to the professor of physiology at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, applying for the vacant post of assistant in his department. The particular professor at that time was Professor Bainbridge. He replied, in addition to rejecting my application, not on unreasonable grounds, that he'd mentioned my interest in clinical electrocardiography to Professor Starling, who wished to carry out work on the electrical activity of the heart, especially in the heart-lung preparation. Professor Starling was prepared to offer me the post of Sharpie Scholar, and would I write to him, give him an answer. This indeed was manna in the wilderness. I wrote, immediately accepting. Our meeting Starling for the first time was an exciting experience. His enthusiasm readily put young people at their ease. And at the interview, he ranged over a wide field of cardiovascular problems, both physiological and clinical, and especially clinical. He said he wanted, amongst other things, for me to join him once a week in attending John Rose Bradford's ward round at University College Hospital so that we could keep our knowledge of clinical medicine up to date. Well, we attended the ward rounds three or four occasions, but after that, we fell by the wayside as the call of the laboratory was too strong. Now, Starling appointed me an assistant. This had the advantage of being a permanent post, but I regret having missed being on the roll of honor of Sharpe's scholars. Now, Baylis, at that time, and I should think for all time, seemed to be the universal provider of knowledge of problems that arose in the laboratory. His charm and kindness were proverbial, and I was fortunate to be his assistant in the general physiology class. In conversation, his approach to a problem was extremely interesting. He would skate about the perimeter of existing knowledge in ever-decreasing circles, until he'd reached as far as possible the center or core of the problem. In this way, he was a marvelous teacher, and hearers picked up an enormous amount of collateral information. He always wore his brown overall in the laboratory, and it had seen much better days. As long as I knew him, it didn't seem to change. I imagine, therefore, that the memo, which I found in one of his notebooks, which runs, overalls, 35 inches, price form, threepence, post free. Supplied by a firm in Newcastle, was a reminder in the event of an emergency which never emerged. Starling spent a good deal of his time in his office, but guided and took part in most of the research activities, which included cardiovascular studies, the secretion of urine, and mechanisms of pancreatic secretion. A surgical operation in 1920, which was mid-time when I was there, and the convalescent period which followed kept him away for some time from the laboratory. But he returned in January 1921. And on the 21st of that month, the staff and their wives celebrated his return by entertaining him to dinner at the Comedy Restaurant in Panton Street. Starling seemed like his former self. It was a great occasion, 7 courses at dinner, potentiated by appropriate libations. Now, the personalities of Baylis and Starling have been illuminated by those who grew up with them in the world of physiology, more especially by Charles Martin, his lifelong friend, by Charles Sherrington, and Joseph Barcroft. And the Baylis-Starling partnership was described by Barcroft as an alliance of two men of complementary genius. But perhaps the most penetrating assessment of their character came from Sherrington. And he wrote of Baylis and Starling, respectively, a resolute but placid enthusiasm of the one met a high tension and impetuous enthusiasm of the other. And that is how we knew them. Their way of life was vividly narrated by Lovett Evans in the first Baylis-Starling Memorial Lecture he delivered only 3 years ago. A little more can be said, except to add that their friendliness, generosity, and humor kindled a great flame of loyalty in all those who worked for them. A particular mention should be made of the revealing biography of Baylis by his son Leonard. Now, physiology has suffered a grievous loss by Leonard's death. I regard him as a great friend. He certainly was a loyal friend and colleague, as he must have been to many of you here. In the course of years, he became very like his father in mannerisms and in outlook, and he also achieved a similar encyclopedic knowledge. I regard it as one of my greatest privileges to have learned so much from both father and son. By 1919, all the pre-war non-professorial staff had dispersed, with the exception of Ruth Skelton. Now, early new appointments, just at the end of the war, were D.T. Harris, the ill-fated Jack Drummond, who was made a reader in physiological chemistry, and 3 years later appointed to the newly created chair of biochemistry. And then in succeeding years, Anrep, Henrietta Bainbridge, Catherine Card, and Verney joined the staff. Now, G.P. Crowden and Grace Palmer, that's our Grace here, were among a number of demonstrators. The visiting research workers included Babkin, who with Anrep was on the second visit to the laboratory. De Boer, a man with a voice like a foghorn, which one heard resounding through the laboratory every time he cannulated a sinus venosus of the frog. Helen Connett Donegan, who's here tonight, N.B. Dreyer, Shelcher, and a Japanese, quite a small crowd. And later in 23, W.E.L. Brown, C.N.H. Long, Lupton, and Parks arrived. The atmosphere in the department was extremely light-hearted. There was a feeling that a new era of intellectual freedom had arrived following the war, which was to end all wars. We arrived at 9 a.m., lunched in the old refectory, had tea in the room, Sharpie's room around the table, as in pre-war days. We left between 5 and 6 p.m. Some of us stayed to work at night, especially those who were working with electrical apparatus. During the day, those who were using galvanometers experienced wide and violent deflections of unknown origin. Overloading of the electrical installation, leaks to earth, and even the starting of the trains in the underground were all suspect. Whatever the reason, the department at night was free from these hazards. I'd like now go back to the earlier days of Bayliss and Starling and trace quite briefly their separate research activities and how these interdigitated with what we may call their combined operations. I'd like slide one, please. Now, in this slide, the dates on the right and left hand correspond with one another. Bayliss's academic lifeline, so to speak, is on the left. Starling's is on the right. Their combined operations in research follows the double line in the center of the slide, starting at 1890. Now, let us leave the details of their researches for the moment, so I want to draw your attention to the initials in square brackets in the center of the slide. Up at the top, you'll find JB-S. Now, these initials indicate the holders of the Jodrell Chair. JBS, of course, refers to John Burton Sanderson, who occupied the chair since 1874, and became Wainfleet Professor of Physiology at Oxford in 1883. It might be said the Burden Sanderson, initiated a quantum migration from the seat of the Jodrell chair to the seat of the Wainfleet chair in Oxford. Now, ESS represents Sharpit Schaefer, who succeeded Burden Sanderson, and EHS, of course, Starling, who succeeded Schaefer in 1890, moving from Guy's. Now, looking back at the top left-hand portion of the slide, Bayliss's first researches at the University College are indicated. They were undertaken with John Rose Bradford on the electrical phenomena accompanying the processes of secretion of the salivary glands and of the skin of the frog, toad, newt, and salamander. He then followed his old chief to Oxford, taking up residence in Wadham College. After 3 years, he obtained a first class in physiology in his final honors school and became a demonstrator in physiology. He then returned to University College again and once more was a demonstrator here, not in this particular lab, of course. Now, the broken lines indicate the period of Bayliss's intellectual diversion to Oxford. Leonard Bayliss recalls that his father, when at Wadham, was affectionately known as Father Bayliss, partly because he was already wearing a beard. He never, in fact, shaved during his life, and partly because he was a little older than most of the undergraduates of his time. Now, if we look at the top right portion of the slide under Starling's name, over the same period of time, Starling had passed from King's College School to Guy's Hospital. His meteoric career was marked by a number of academic prizes, 2 exhibitions, and several medals. He became a demonstrator in physiology at Guy's in the same year as Bayliss became a demonstrator at University College. Now, if you look at the year 1890, this was a remarkable year for several reasons. Both Bayliss and Starling were elected members of the Physiological Society. They started work together at University College while Starling was still at Guy's. Starling took his MD, and he also published his first paper in collaboration with Gowland Hopkins, entitled Note on the Urine in a Case of Phosphorus Poisoning. There's no direct evidence that Bayliss and Starling met before 1890, although according to Schaefer's history of the society, each had twice attended society meetings at Guest's before 1890, but on separate occasions. Schaefer, however, does not always record Guest's, so it is possible they met before 1890. Whilst this slide is on the screen, I want to point out Bayliss and Starling's separate and combined researches as they progressed over the years. Some of these I'll refer to in more detail later. Looking at the double line in the center of the slide, starting EMF, mammalian heart. This was our first research on the electrical activity and nervous control of the mammalian heart. Now, during the following 7 years or so, they studied, and these are very important studies, as it turned out, intravascular pressure changes following mechanical interference with the circulation at various sites. They also worked on the innervation of the intestines and the movements of the intestines. Whilst these joint researches were going on mostly at University College, Bayliss was working on his own, investigating depressor nerve function and vascular reflex, while Starling, also on his own, was working on lymph production and absorption of body fluids. Towards the end of the period, 1899, which you see, which is on the level with EHS when Starling became Jodrell Professor, they once more joined forces in a study on the nature of the control of intestinal movements, in this case, the large intestine. And whilst this was in progress, as I say, Starling became Jodrell Professor. Their discovery of secretin and the evolution of the concept of the chemical regulation of the secretory process came later. This story, epitomized in a unique joint Croonian lecture delivered before the Royal Society in 1904, was the peak of their combined operations. Bayliss's records in the Thane Library are really of considerable interest. I recommend people to read them. And I'm indebted to Mr. Marmoy, the librarian, for making these available. They record Bayliss's wide interests in biology, physics, and chemistry. There are entries relating to such a wide diversity of subjects as photographic developers, photoelectric cells, fluorescent screens, Marconi transmitters, anesthetics for earthworms, and so forth. There is also a photograph of his room at Wadham in Oxford. Next slide, that's slide two, please. On the back of this photograph, in his writing, which I recognize, "My room at Wadham, autotype sepia." The photograph was no doubt taken by himself, as he was an expert photographer. And you will see it has comfortable chairs, a fire with a kettle on the hob, a pipe rack, truly the home of comfort and learning, as the fourth Wainfleet Professor of Physiology once described Oxford to me. May I have the lights, please? The first 10 years or so of the Bayliss-Starling partnership were devoted to cardiovascular studies. And it is these and those of Starling, carried out much later on the heart-lung preparation, which I wish to mention in more detail. When they started their first research together on the electrical activity of the mammalian heart, the direction of the excitation wave was unknown. They used direct leads from the dog's heart and recorded EMF changes with a capillary electrometer. String galvanometers were not known. They made four important observations. The first, the contrary to previous views, the base of the mammalian heart becomes negative before the apex, and that the direction of the wave could be reversed by respiring the animal with cold air, very elementary experimental precaution which others had failed to take. The second, that the excitatory state of the base outlasts that of the apex. And the third was that the previously observed tetanic nature of cardiac contraction claimed by others is not present, but is an artifact due to the shaking of their apparatus. Finally, perhaps their most important observation, that the delay between auricular and ventricular contraction was the order of 0.15 seconds. They comment that this delay, coupled with the fact the transmission across the AV junction is possible in either direction, points to a direct muscular continuity between auricles and ventricles. Now, this prophecy was made 2 years before Stanley Kent, and I should add Hiss, also in the same year, published their discoveries of the specialized tissue running through the auricular-ventricular fibrous ring. Now, Waller was the first to record an electrocardiogram of the human heart, but his records gave no certain indications of the direction of the excitation wave, so Bayliss and Starling set to work to clarify the problem. For this purpose, they had to visit John Burden Sanderson's laboratory in Oxford,
where a more sensitive electrometer was available, and also an electric arc, so that a greater magnification was possible than with the limelight they had to use at University College. They again found that the base of the heart becomes negative before the apex. Could I have slide 3, please? Now, this slide represents 3 electrocardiograms. Those are the solid tracings. And on the top, as a time marker tracing of a tenth of a second, and the next one is the carotid pulse. And the next one down is the electrocardiogram of Starling. Now, if we come down further, there again is the time marker, which was broken down, and the electrocardiogram of Bayliss. And below that is a time marker, which was only temporarily interrupted, and the time and the electrocardiogram of a morphinized dog. I should say that these tracings read from right to left. So you see the R wave and the T wave, but no P wave. Lights, please. Now, in the same year that they were working on the ECG, Bayliss and Starling showed that stimulation of the cardiosympathetic nerves caused positive chrono and inotropic effects on the auricles and on the ventricles, and also improved conduction between the auricles and ventricles. Vagal stimulation produced effects opposite to these, but it was not possible to demonstrate any direct inotropic effect on the ventricles. Now, more or less concurrently with these cardiac studies, Starling, already interested in the relationship between capillary pressure and the processes of secretion and transudation, was joined by Bayliss to examine the problem more closely. What they were after was the factors which determine capillary pressures. And they measured the arterial, systemic venous, and portal venous pressures under a great variety of experimental conditions. And they concluded it was fallacious to argue, as had been done hitherto, that a fall in arterial pressure necessarily implied a fall of pressure in all the capillary areas of the body. This was a fundamental observation. Moreover, they drew attention to the importance of venous pressure in determining capillary pressures and adumbrated the role of capacitor vessels in hemodynamics. As Starling, armed with this knowledge, continued his studies on his own, at Guy's, on lymph formation and fluid exchanges in the body. And these culminated in the measurements of the osmotic pressure of serum proteins and the concept that at any given moment there's a balance between the hydrostatic pressure of the blood in the capillaries and the osmotic attraction of the blood to the surrounding fluids. That is how he put it. Now, these studies laid the foundation for present-day views as to the relative actions of the vasomotor system in controlling fluid exchange and excretion of electrolytes. It seemed an inevitable step that Starling, whose mind was still occupied with clinical problems, should attempt to weld these laboratory findings into a scheme which would explain the processes involved in chronic cardiac failure associated with dropsy. His masterly expositions in 6 Aris and Gale lectures in 1896-97 on this subject still remain the center around which discussions abound. As Starling's last paper before he became Jodrell Professor was published from Guy's, it concerned the glomerular function of the kidney. But it was some 20 years before he came back the studies of renal function, and this he did in collaboration with Verney. Now, some remarks about Bayliss, because immediately after his return to University College, Bayliss started the series of investigations on a subject on which he perhaps is best known, on vascular reflexes. And these were to continue over the next 10 years, although he and Starling were working together over that same period. Bayliss showed that depressor nerve stimulation reflexly dilated the blood vessels of the head and neck, as well as those of the skin and muscles. Now, previously, the vasodilator response was thought to be confined to the region supplied by the splanchnic nerves. He then started his work on the nature of the vasodilator response in the limbs following dorsal root nerve stimulation. He noted that the responses lasted several minutes, were easily obtainable by mechanical, thermal and chemical stimulation, as well, of course, as by electrical stimulation. He showed that the fibers concerned in these responses were afferent, and he named them antidromic. Now, in his 1901 paper, Bayliss considered four possibilities as to the nature of the response to antidromic nerve stimulation. The first, he thought that impulses might reach muscle spindles and set up changes, chemical or otherwise. It's interesting, chemical or otherwise, which somehow affected the blood vessels. But he discarded this view on finding that the chief seat of the vasodilatation was in the skin. The second possibility he considered was that an axon reflex of the Langley type was involved. But this he regarded as unlikely because of the long latent period between the start of stimulation and the beginning of the response. And the third, that if sensory and motor fibers end in a common periarterial plexus, as it was thought at that time, it may happen that antidromic impulses may spread to the plexus and so excite the motor fibers. And the fourth and last possibility, which to his mind presented the fewest inherent difficulties, was that the same nerve terminations in the vascular smooth muscle serve both sensory and motor function. Today, the commonly accepted view is one which Bayliss originally discarded, but in later years accepted, namely that an axon reflex is involved. And it now seems possible the antidromic vasodilatation may be due to the liberation of a chemical substance in the tissues, possibly ATP. Bayliss also studied the reaction of blood vessels to alterations in their internal pressure, the so-called autoregulation of blood flow by this means. He was the first to show in denervated limbs that a passive distension of the blood vessels leads to their active constriction and a passive collapse to their active relaxation. These effects are now regarded as taking place or taking part in the autoregulation of blood flow. And at a recent symposium on the subject, in which there were 60 delegates from all over the world, the variability of results obtained on various vascular territories was stressed. A very large number of hypotheses were put forward, and the chairman, in summarizing some 40 papers, was driven to remark that the question as to how autoregulation came about has generated the most heat. After their work on pancreatic secretion, Bayliss and Starling's research interests diverged. Bayliss devoted himself largely to the study of enzyme action and to writing. And this was up to the start of the First World War. and by that time it might be supposed that his scientific reputation could reach no higher. But in the same year, the full realization of his knowledge and scientific achievements burst upon the scientific world when he published his monumental book, Principles of General Physiology. This was dedicated to Starling, his fellow worker. There was only one criticism of this book, if it might be so called. There appeared in the Times Literary Supplement of the day when it came out, or after, day after, a comment which I think now faintly echoes throughout the academic world. It ran, "Latin, for better, for worse, is no longer current among men of science." Or Professor Baylis would have called this mighty book Principia Physiologica. As Starling wrote later, the book not only treats of the science, but it is at the same time a revolution, a revelation of the personality of the writer, and is indeed the history of a mind and its achievements. In 1910, Starling once more returned to problems of cardiac function. He recognized the urgency for a more complete understanding of cardiac regulation in the absence of nervous and humoral influences, and started experiments with the heart-lung preparation. In that year, a new arrival appeared in the laboratory, the Sharpie scholar, who was to take a major part in the investigations. Slide 4, please. Now, it was Lovett Evans and Matsuoka who was very largely responsible, more Lovett Evans, demonstrating a parallel between cardiac work and cardiac volume, and also a parallel between the oxygen usage of the heart and cardiac volume. Now, Lovett Evans also found that for any given increase in the work of the heart, more oxygen was used by raising the aortic pressure at a constant cardiac output than by raising the output at a constant aortic pressure. Up to this time, 50 years later, all these results have been confirmed. Let us start from the beginning with the technique of the heart-lung preparation. Slide 5, please. Most of you will not recognize. It is the first heart-lung preparation made in 1881 by Newell Martin at the Johns Hopkins University. And it consisted of a large chamber, which you can see covering the whole of the slide, in which the whole animal was placed, but the heart only is shown in this particular picture. And on the left, you will see two 700 cc cylinders. Here we are. Two 700 cc cylinders here, which contained the blood, which fed the blood into the heart through the superior vena cava, and then heart went in the normal way out through one branch of the aorta, brachiocephalic, because we're using dogs, and then came back again through a stopcock into a graduated cylinder here. Another branch came from the aorta, left subclavian, to take the blood pressure. Now, in this technique, each reservoir on the left, or cylinders, fed the heart alternately. And the procedure was that directly this graduated cylinder on the left, which collected the peripheral outflow, was full. It was poured into one of the reservoirs, and directly that was full, the stopcocks at the top were changed over, and the other reservoir fed the heart. And so it went on, the whole changeover being made, of course, by hand. Now, considering the complexity of the apparatus, it really was a remarkable achievement to get the animal switched over from the natural to the artificial circulation. But naturally, it had limitations. The apparatus had limitations for the measurement of cardiac performance. A uniform series of consecutive observations with large flows were limited by the time required for changing over the venous reservoirs by hand. And 2 liters of calves' defibrinated blood were necessary to start off the experiment. And calves' blood is very toxic for heart and lungs. Again, the control of the systemic circulation by means of an adjustable stopcock was unsatisfactory. Nevertheless, Neil Martin and later Howland Donaldson made some important observations. They found that the heart rate increased with the temperature of the blood, and that the rate depends more on the temperature of the coronary blood than that of the blood in the right atrium. And secondly, variations in flow or in aortic pressure did not affect the heart rate. And some 25 years later, Jerusalem Starling attempted to make a more workable heart-lung preparation. It too was not very successful because the mercury valve they used in the systemic circulation for adjusting the arterial pressure was unsatisfactory. But they made advances in other directions. A relatively small volume of blood was required, and therefore homologous blood could be used in the heart. And again, there was a continuous flow of blood in our apparatus through the external circuit into a single reservoir, thence back to the heart. And the total cardiac output was measured by a cardiometer. The next important advance was made 2 years later when Knowlton and Starling replaced the mercury resistance by the well-known Starling resistor. And this was followed by the additional measurement of coronary flow by Lovett Evans and Starling and Markwalder and Starling. And finally, as regards technique, Patterson and Starling fitted much wider bore tubing throughout the circuit to diminish the resistance to blood flow through the tubes exerted by the viscosity of the blood. In this way, they were able to obtain much higher cardiac outputs than previously. In one experiment, they obtained 10 times the value of that of the resting dog. Then Patterson, Pieper, and Starling further improved the potentialities of the apparatus by using optical methods for recording simultaneously the left ventricular pressure together with the left atrial pressure or cardiac volume. The slide 6, please. This familiar diagram is put on the screen merely to remind you that, contrary to what has been stated since, that the left atrial pressure was taken, and it was taken in conjunction with the left ventricular pressure, and you can plot left atrial pressures against left ventricular pressures from the work of Patterson and Starling, Table 3, if you want to look it up. And they also recorded these pressures optically. Lights, please. And the experiments performed by Starling and his collaborators, chiefly with Patterson and later with Pieper, which led to the formulation of the law of the heart, are too well known to require repetition. There are, however, certain of their observations on cardiac tone or contractility of special interest in relation to present-day conception. They confirmed the earlier work, which Bayliss and Starling did, that sympathetic nerve stimulation produced a positive chrononinotropic effect. And they observed that the cardiac acceleration persisted for a minute or more after the end of nerve stimulation. And this is of interest in view of present-day knowledge of the release of the transmitter in the region of cardiosympathetic nerve terminations. And later, it was shown that adrenaline lowered the venous pressure, accelerated the heart, emptied the heart more completely, sometimes increased stroke volume, and raised the rate of rise of intraventricular tension. And that last one is one which is exercising the minds of workers today, the rate of rise of intraventricular tension. Of equal interest was our observation that a sudden rise in aortic pressure led to an increase in the volume of the heart, followed after a short time by a recovery towards its initial volume, that is, by an increase in tone, a late increase in tone. Now, this increase in tone was attributed by Starling to an improved coronary circulation. This interpretation probably only relates to hearts with an initial deficient coronary blood flow. That alternative suggestion made by Knowlton and Starling, that the increase in ventricular tension due to the aortic pressure rise might improve cardiac performance, is more in line with views held at the present time. Now, Enrop, at Starling's suggestion, examined the problem more closely. He found that the late increase in ventricular tone, which I've just described, and which is produced by an aortic pressure rise, was accompanied by a diminution in systolic and diastolic volumes of the heart, an effect which was potentiated by the administration of adrenaline or by splanchnic nerve stimulation. Now, further experiments carried out by Enrop showed that in the presence of adrenaline, an imposed fall in aortic pressure caused first a decrease and then an increase in the volume of the heart. Now, Enrop made the interesting comment that this indicated that the heart tends to maintain its volume constant, but that the power of the heart to react in this way to changes in arterial resistance is dependent upon adrenaline as a constituent of the circulating blood or of the heart muscle itself. And this certainly bears further thought. These main results, which I described, should be examined in relation to those which have since been obtained by other forms of experimentation with improved methods of recording. We must remember that Starling and his school obtained their results with recording instruments having distinct limitations. With the exception of the optical manometers used by Patterson, Pieper, and Starling, the available instruments were water manometers, a cardiometer, and a piston recorder. Today, there are transducers galore for measuring pressures, blood flows, volume changes, and movements in various parts of the body. Sensing probes of various types are inserted in every available orifice, natural or handmade, to gather the required information. Cardiac volume changes are calculated from the results obtained by X-ray techniques for delineating the outline of the heart in two planes or the outline of the ventricular chamber by the injection of a radio-opaque substance. There are various electronic devices for measuring in the beating heart changes in its circumference, in the internal diameter of the ventricle, and in the length of a myocardial segment. With all these skills and techniques, the simultaneous measurement and recording of a large number of parameters has become possible, some of which can be simultaneously integrated or differentiated with the aid of computers, thus saving much time. Of greater importance has been the information conditions governing cardiac performance gained from experiments on isolated cardiac papillary muscle preparations or on the isolated heart continually perfused with blood from a living donor and on the heart in situ in which the volume inflow and outflow flow resistance are under separate control. Now, these last-named intact heart preparations differ from the Starling heart-lung preparation in that they receive blood which is continually passing through another or the same animal. Now, as to later developments, in particular with reference to ventricular stroke work stroke power, and ventricular contractility. Starling used the term cardiac or ventricular tone to denote the energy set free per unit length of muscle fiber at each contraction of the ventricle. The term contractility, as used nowadays, has a somewhat different meaning. In fact, it has several meanings. It has been defined in terms of the relationship between ventricular end-diastolic pressure, or fiber length, and external stroke power. Thus, when from any given length of fiber, the ventricle produces more external stroke work and more external stroke power, calculated as stroke work per systolic second, an increase in contractility is said to have taken place. And defined in this way, contractility in isolated supported heart preparations, that is, blood taken from another animal, contractility is increased by a sustained rise in aortic pressure, or in afterload, by the infusion of noradrenaline and other catecholamines, by a sympathetic nerve stimulation, and by a sustained increase in heart rate. In all cases, the rate of rise of interventricular tension is increased, as well as the stroke work, and therefore stroke power is also increased. Our studies on cardiac papillary muscle have been largely influenced by A.V. Hill's work on the force-velocity relations of skeletal muscle. The tension-length curve of these preparations resembles that of from a frog's gastrocnemius, and a force-velocity curve is of the usual type. The maximal velocity of shortening of the papillary muscle is the parameter which is of chief interest just at this moment, because it is not altered by changes in preload, in length, or by changes in afterload, whereas it is increased by noradrenaline, a raised frequency of contraction, and by increasing the calcium content of the fluid in which it is immersed. The increase in the maximal velocity of shortening is always associated with a decrease in the time to peak shortening. It is claimed that these two changes best define an increase in contractility. It should be noted that contractility, defined in this way, is not changed by an increase in afterload. Now, if this is so, well, I should mention that in the intact heart, just as in the cardiac papillary muscle, noradrenaline, or an increase in the rate of contraction, decreases the time to peak shortening. And this is taken as an indirect evidence that the maximum velocity of shortening is also increased. And more recent work, which I haven't had time, because it's only come out this last few weeks, supports this view. If this is so, it means, as prophesied by Hill 10 years ago, that cardiac muscle possesses the ability to alter work and power at any one load and fiber length by shifting its force-velocity curve. I wanted to talk just a little about exercise in man, because Starling had very important views on exercise in man, which came out in two lectures. One, the Lineker lecture, which was delivered in 1915, and one, the Royal Army Medical College lecture, which was delivered in 1919. And he changed his views considerably between those 4 years. Little is known about this last lecture, and we owe a great debt to Dr. Carlton B. Chapman, who last year was responsible with Dr. Jerry H. Mitchell for reprinting in book form Starling's most important publications, including both these lectures. In the earlier lecture, Starling was talking about the law of the heart, and he thought that in exercise, the law of the heart operated, that the increased work was due to was carried out by an increased length of fibre, but he also thought that as the aortic pressure rose, that the coronary circulation was increased and the heart became better nourished, and that increased myocardial tone, and I quote, then the heart gradually returns to its normal volume, although it is doing increased work. But in his later lecture, he was concentrating attention more on man as a whole and not on the isolated heart. But he repeats in this later lecture what he said in his first lecture on the law of the heart. And then he considers the effects of a reflex control of the heart superimposed upon the mechanisms which he described in his law of the heart. These, he wrote, come into play when, as a result of the steady increase in diastolic inflow due to increasing muscular activity, the heart just fills the pericardium. So with increasing inflow, the heart gets wider and wider until finally it comes up against the pericardial resistance. The heart then quickens and the venous pressure falls because Bainbridge's reflex comes into operation. With increasing inflow, this reflex acceleration progresses until the heart is beating at its maximum stroke and maximum rate. He then superimposes upon this background, in his argument, the effect of adrenaline release into the circulation causes a further acceleration and an augmentation in the energy of the heart at each beat. And finally, Starling points out that all these mechanisms can take place in an animal deprived of its cerebral cortex, and that on top of these, we must imagine the cortex taking charge of initiating and controlling the reflex mechanisms. He leaves no doubt as to his views when he says, and I quote, the part played by the higher centers involves changes in the heart respiration and circulation, anticipatory of and of a similar character to those which will be excited by the muscular activity itself. And perhaps the most telling and graphic passage in the RAMC, that's the last lecture, relates to the value which Starling placed upon the work from his own laboratory. He wrote, the extraordinary powers of which the heart muscle is endowed represent but the central fortress of the system, and under normal conditions are protected and to a large extent prevented from coming into play by the activities of the defending positions and outposts provided by the central nervous system and its servants. It is only when these other defenses fail that the heart is called upon to display those reactions which are at once brought to light in our study of the isolated organ. When it is remembered that Starling delivered this lecture nearly 50 years ago, it was a remarkable imaginative forecast of many of the present-day conceptions of the integrating mechanisms brought into play by exercise. Now, in this lecture, I've only covered a very limited field of Bayliss and Starling's research activities. I end with the thought that in the course of time, here in this latter-day scientific home of these two great masters, all aspects of their scientific achievements and ideas upon which so much has been built will be analyzed and criticized, as surely they themselves would have wished. But this is not all, for we must also reflect that their lives were enriched by an almost lifelong friendship, by a close family association, and by the affectionate regard of all those who had the good fortune to work for them. What greater destiny can man desire?
first lecture that there should be no vote of thanks, but you have already given one for this excellent analysis, which we have all enjoyed very much. I should like just to add at the Secretary's request that those who wish can have sherry.